Do you want me to continue with Lake Study?
Yeah, our next next presentation will be on our Iliamna Lake Study. We'll go from there. Thank you.
Yes, keep the questions coming. This is great. It's good questions. The Iliamna Lake Study was started in 2005 as a response to some discussions that we were having with agency folks about the need to get some baseline data in the lake. I would have to say that this is probably one of my favorite studies that I was involved in out at the project site, because you were required to have at least decent weather conditions to go out on the lake. So I'm not going to say it always looks like this out there. It looks pretty calm out there in this picture, but generally that lake could really kick up and be a little bit dangerous if you were out there when there were poor conditions. So we were looking for great conditions to be out there. I'm going to talk about the study objectives and the methodology in QAQC. Quick overview of the EBD results and discussion for the four primary study areas parameters that we studied out there: the surface water quality, sediments, freshwater mussels, and the zooplankton, and give you a snapshot of the study team and some take-home points. The objective of the Iliamna Lake Study was to characterize baseline conditions at select sites in the northeast zone of Iliamna Lake for water quality, zooplankton, sediments, and muscle tissue. And I want to be very clear that when we say Iliamna Lake Study, we do not mean that we're characterizing everything in the lake or the entire lake system. We really were focused on the north end area that would likely be receiving waters that were coming from the study areas for the proposed mine and proposed road corridors. This table is a little bit difficult to read, but if you want to take a look at the EBD, you can study it in a little more detail. I just wanted to put this up here because it gives you a snapshot of our program evolution over time, starting in 2005, going through 2006, and then in 2007. We did have four primary sites that were set up for freshwater mussel monitoring. Those are the top three in this list: Bucket Lake, Finn Bay, Flat Island, and then the last one, Whistlewing Bay. Now, those were sampled primarily for freshwater mussels, and we tried to get at least one sediment and one water quality sample for each of those four sites as well, just to get an idea of what was cycling through the freshwater mussels in terms of metals and organics. Then we had five primary water quality sites, and we call these in the report deeper water sites because they were sites that were generally around 20 meters deep. And we focused in on water quality at those sites and zooplankton sampling. And then we also got some sediments with an Ekman dredge out there. Those were Knutson Bay, Northeast Bay, Pyle Bay, Roadhouse Bay, and Upper Tularet Creek. And we did not sample in Upper Tularet Creek for this. We sampled further out into the water body of the lake, as you'll see on the upcoming map. Here is a map of our sites. Those four freshwater mussel sites that I just told you about are on here. There we go. Okay. Bucket Lake, Flat Island, Finn Bay, and Whistlewing Bay. And the other five sites that we just talked about are Upper Tularet. You can see Upper Tularet coming down into the Iliamna Lake system here, and we sampled out into the lake from where that waterway enters Iliamna Lake. Northeast Bay, Knutson Bay, Pyle Bay, and Roadhouse Bay, which is right near Iliamna. We did look at field parameter measurements. We recorded temperature, dissolved oxygen, pH, conductivity, and ORP. We also looked at turbidity at each site. And we got Secchi disk measurements at those deep water sites. Obviously, we didn't need to do that at the freshwater mussel sites. They were fairly shallow. But at those five deeper water sites, we got Secchi disk measurements. Again, at those five deeper water sites, we took water quality samples using an 8-liter Niskin sampler. And I know you're going to see a bigger picture of that from the ocean guys later on, but there's a picture that I've included here that shows what the Niskin bottle looks like. You basically drop it in the water, pull the trigger, and it collects a water sample in there, and then it has a nozzle that you empty the water out into your sample bottles. We collected at 3 depths at the surface, 1 meter above the substrate, and then halfway between that distance. And I will say that when we ran the statistics between those 3 different depths, we saw very little change between those 3 depths. So in our data analysis, for the most part, we ended up combining those samples together, because there was no statistical difference between them. So we figured it was fairly well mixed. Again, dissolved metals were filtered by the field team with a 0.45 micron filter and a peristaltic pump back at the field hut. Samples were then packaged up and transferred to Shaw, Alaska for shipping to the laboratories. And I know Jane talked about that. I think it was Jane that talked about that earlier on in the process. It's also, details are included in the QAP if you're interested in that information. We looked at 23 total and dissolved trace metals, 9 major cations and anions, pH, TDS, TSS, alkalinity, hardness, cyanides, organics. And the organics, we did those once per year. We didn't do those every sampling event. Sediments in the deep water sites were collected using an Ekman dredge. It's a bit challenging at 20 meters depth, but we generally did get at least one sediment sample for each site in the deeper water areas. Those samples were shipped to the laboratories and analyzed for PAHs, total metals, mercury, cyanide, fluoride, sulfate, chloride, and ammonia. Mussels were sampled because they're sensitive to water quality. They tend to bioaccumulate metals in their system, and that is very well documented in the literature. I have one reference up here. Primarily, they will bioaccumulate or store cadmium, then copper, mercury, nickel, chromium, and zinc. I think selenium is on that list as well, but that is a bit of an emerging technology or emerging issue. So the mussels that we sampled, the species was Anodonta bringiana, and we're not talking about tiny little mussels here. We're talking these things could get up to 6 inches long. So they were quite large, quite meaty. We sampled those using a clam basket, and those samples were frozen and shipped to the laboratory where they were analyzed for PAHs and total metals. Zooplankton was collected with a plankton tow net. Vertical tows were collected at each of those 5 deeper water sites, and the samples were brought to Anchorage and processed by HDR scientists. We identified those zooplankton samples to class and order when possible. I want to be clear that this is not the same level of analysis, for example, with the invertebrate program. We were really just trying to get a snapshot of what's out there, so we didn't go all the way down to species for the zooplankton for the study. The project operates under a QAP, which has been described before. It also operates under a field sampling plan, which very clearly details the clean hands, dirty hands process and other clean procedures, sampling equipment and how it's to be cleaned, the 10% QAQC program with duplicates and triplicates, the equipment rinse blanks that need to happen on a regular schedule, DI blanks, mercury trips, and trip blanks. And then I know Shaw was out there at least once a year doing a field audit, going along with the project team to make sure that every procedure was being followed correctly. And sometimes I think they did that more than once a year. So I'm going to give you a quick overview of the water quality results. For that study, we did collect 176 water quality samples for the study, for the Iliamna Lakes study. Most samples were homogeneous at depth, as I described before. Obviously, pH and temperature, you would expect those to vary with depth. Those were a few of the exceptions. The lake can generally be classified as oligotrophic and dimictic. Dimictic means it overturns twice a year. Water quality parameters are similar to other regional lakes, except for the parameters of pH, alkalinity, copper, lead, aluminum, iron, and manganese. And you'll see in the report we delve into those a little bit more about how they differ just a little bit from other studies in the project area. Pyle Bay appeared to have higher concentrations of analytes, and as you remember, Pyle Bay is one of those five deeper water sites, so we analyze those a little bit different than the mussel sites. Among the mussel sites, Bucket Lake seemed to have higher concentrations of analytes. Not a big surprise, given that Bucket Lake, if you've been out at the project site, Bucket Lake is right there where the community is also located, so it's not as well mixed and just downstream of the community there. Alkalinity in the project area is generally low, and I know Mark talked about that yesterday as well. The results in the lake are very similar to what was found in the mine site area. We hear a lot these days about selenium and mercury. Selenium and mercury were undetected or relatively low in concentration in the water quality in Iliamna Lake. Just a few graphs here that describe what we saw. Again, check out the EBD. It's got a lot more detail and a lot more graphs. So here we have on the x-axis the months that we sampled, May through October, open water conditions. And then we have pH on the y-axis. And in general, the pH was fairly normal between 6.5 and an 8. You don't see that on this graph, but because these are averages, but we did get pHs closer towards 8, a little bit basic, but not unusual, not unanticipated. Pyle Bay averages go down below 6 pH and, you know, slightly acidic, but again, not unusual compared to what was found in some other proposed mine site results. And here we have temperature profiles for the lake, and these are averages between June 2005 and June 2007. And we have along the x-axis, we have temperature in degrees C. Along the y-axis, we have depth, and you're reading it as if this is the surface and you're going deeper. So in June, you can see a little bit of stratification based on temperature. By September, most of that stratification has worked its way out, and things are fairly well mixed, pretty much at the same temperature. And then you would expect in the wintertime, as the lake freezes over, the water at the top would be colder than the water at the bottom. So you'd potentially have a dimictic lake system there. Here we have DO graph with the months along the x-axis and dissolved oxygen in milligrams per liter along the y-axis. What we notice is earlier on in the summer is that the dissolved oxygen is a bit higher, and then it drops off as you get towards August, and that could be potentially correlated with temperature. We know that the dissolved oxygen and temperature have inverse relationships, so that's potentially one explanation of that. We're talking about alkalinity in this graph, and again, we have our months along the x-axis and alkalinity in milligrams per liter on the y-axis. These results are very similar to what Mark was presenting yesterday. They are below the chronic aquatic life criteria, which for most parameters is a good thing, but for alkalinity, not quite as much. Alkalinity is one of those standards that you want to be above the 20 milligrams per liter standard, because that helps with the buffering capability of the waters. And then we have a box plot shown with the 20 milligrams per liter standard on here, and the stations along the bottom. So you can see how alkalinity varies by Knutson Bay, Northeast Bay, Pyle Bay, Roadhouse Bay, and Upper Tularuk. In general, nitrates, nitrites, and even phosphorus were fairly low. As I mentioned, it's a oligotrophic lake, so nutrients are generally low out of the project site. Total dissolved solids are also low. The standard of 500 milligrams per liter is much higher than what we're seeing out of the project site. The averages are below 40 for these sites, and the individual data points very rarely went too far above that. So here we have median total major ions in 2005 and in 2007. This is just for Northeast Bay. I tried to pick some example graphs that would show some of the highest values. So when you look at the report, you can examine these trends a little bit more in detail, but you can expect that at the other sites, they probably were even lower than what we're showing here. We have calcium, magnesium, sodium, and potassium on the y-axis, and again, the months on the x-axis. Secondary y-axis, we have sulfates and chloride in milligrams per liter. And the point I wanted to make here is these are some of our highest concentrations found. They're still fairly low. So, low amounts of calcium, magnesium, potassium, sodium, sulfate, and chloride at the project site. So here we have magnesium, potassium, and sodium, calcium at Northeast Bay. And we have a dip here in late July / early August. Not quite sure what is going on with that, but these are the types of trends that we've identified in the report. The data are not of a beefy robustness that we can potentially identify some of the reasons for these, but potential trends are identified in the report. Median aluminum, iron, manganese in 2005 and 2007. Point I wanted to make here is that total aluminum starts out low, kind of jumps up high in June, and then trails off during the rest of the summer. Dissolved aluminum is a little bit variable, as are some of the others, but pretty much close to the MRL. So again, not a whole lot going on in terms of high levels of metals at the project site. And then just one more here for Pyle Bay, and we have again months on the x-axis. And we have arsenic, copper, lead, moly, and nickel in micrograms per liter along the y-axis, and zinc in micrograms per liter along the secondary. Again, results very, very low. So things are pretty low out there. Hugh described a Piper plot yesterday, so I won't go into the details of how those work. But we did do one of the Piper plots for the Iliamna Lake study, and again, we found calcium bicarbonate waters to be the case. Quick overview of the sediment and mussel results. The highest median concentrations of most of those metals were found in Bucket Lake. The exception to that was nickel, and that was found in Fin Bay. The highest concentrations of lead and nickel in sediments were also found in Bucket Lake. And mercury in mussels ranged from 0.053 to 0.282 milligrams per kilogram. Again, the highest in Bucket Lake. No mercury was detected in water and sediments. Organic constituents in mussel tissues were below the MRLs. RROs were above the MRL in sediments in Bucket Lake, Flat Island, and Fin Bay. PAHs were above the MRL in Bucket Lake in sediments. So here we have a few graphs where we took information from the mussel tissue analysis and the sediment and the water in this in, uh, and, in co-located areas and put those together to see what types of trends we could start to identify. It's not true trend analysis, obviously, because we don't have enough data, but just to get a picture of what things look at, like out there, and specifically for the elements that we mentioned earlier that tend to bioaccumulate in freshwater mussels. So I started out with copper, and here we have copper results for the sediments, mussels, and the water. The water's in the light column, mussel is in the gray shaded column here, and then sediment is in the dark column. The interesting thing to note here is that there's no apparent relationship between copper and water sediments and mussels in this scenario. Again, like I said, not enough data to be conclusive, but not really seeing a whole lot in terms of matching up those data. When we get over to zinc in the sediments seem to fluctuate a little bit with zinc in the water, but not in the mussels. So if you look at the zinc in the water, and then over here at Bucket Lake, it's higher, and then we start to see higher levels of zinc as well. Again, over here in Flat Island, it's a little bit low, and zinc's dropping back down again. So zinc may be a little bit more bioaccumulative based on the freshwater mussels exposure to that in sediments or water. Selenium, as we mentioned, was not found in water. So here we have the sediments in the dark column and the mussels in the lighter column. Selenium also may fluctuate in mussel tissues and in sediments, just based on some very preliminary graphing of the results. So here's a representation of our zooplankton results in 2005 and in 2007. We have the months along the x-axis, and along the y-axis we have the averages of those major groups, taxonomic groups. Copepods and rotifers seem to be dominant in these systems, at least during the summer months that we sampled. Copepods and cladocerans, as noted in the purple, cladocerans, as noted in the purple, seem to increase as we go throughout the summer, as you can see here. And when we look at the zooplankton taxa in terms of taxa composition, not just numbers, but taxa composition for each site, you can see in May that those are primarily copepods, and then later on in the summer, as in October, the cladocerans are starting to move in and take over more of the taxa composition dominance. So we had a few ideas as to why that might be happening. Perhaps it's related again to fish feeding patterns, but that would have to be sussed out later on. Just a few take-home points. Some results are above the chronic aquatic life criteria, which gets to Phil's question. We did see that in lead, iron, moly, and nickel, and a few other elements. Alkalinity is often below the criteria, which speaks to the ability of those waters to buffer different levels of pH. Nutrients were fairly low at most sites. And if you take a look at the EBD, you'll be able to see way more graphs, way more detail than what I presented here. And just as an overall comment, most of the results of what we found in terms of metals and organics as part of the study were fairly low, relatively low. Who has the first question?
Bob Seale, USGS. When you had your table up there that had your different media, different sampling years, things like that, I thought I noticed that for sediment, Upper Tularet Creek was one area where you haven't sampled sediment at all. Is that true?
We tried to get sediment from that site. That site in particular is pretty rocky because it's getting a lot of that outwash from the creek itself. And we couldn't get fine-grained enough sediments using the Ekman dredge that we were using. We kept dropping it down and bringing it up, and it just wouldn't, the Ekman wouldn't close. The sediment was just too cobbly.
I guess just considering the site, since, you know, if you look at the whole lake, that's the one area where you might expect high concentrations from weathering of the deposit. And then if a mine's put in operation, that's the one area that likely receive the highest impact. It almost seems to me like it would be essential to give that area a lot of detail consideration, even go into deeper water where it may not be cobbly, but that's the one area in the whole lake where I think detailed work is needed. So,
thanks, Bob.
Good comment. Thank you.
Cindy Godsey, EPA. So going off of Phil's question of before, did you find any differences in, I guess, statistical differences in the amount of critters that you found in places where the criteria was naturally above or below what it should be?
We didn't match that up. We didn't match those two ideas up in terms of our analysis.
Something to think about going forward with our data.
Yep. Thanks, Cindy.
Other questions, comments?
Phil North, Environmental Protection Agency. What about seals? Are seals going to be discussed somewhere in all this discussion?
I can take that one, Andrew. We have had some proposals submitted to the partnership proposing seal studies in the Lake Eliamna itself, and so far we've not funded those, but we definitely have some ideas and thoughts about maybe at some point some tissue samples. Part of it is, you know, it's not a very big population, and you got to be careful about sampling the population itself. And so we haven't really worked through those things, and we're still in a kind of a thought process about how to execute a program like that and such. But yeah, we definitely have talked about that.
Rick Parkin, Environmental Protection Agency. It looked like you just did temperature profiles in June and September. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, did it look like we only did temperature profiles in June? No. In the report, you'll see them perform for each month. Mm-hmm. I just put those up there as an example of the differences.
Okay, well, for the intervening months, did the stratification become more pronounced than it was in June?
For some sites, the last one that I put up there, which was October, was our last month. We didn't sample beyond October at the project site, but, you know, understandably, that's where we saw the biggest differences in stratification. So the months before that, we didn't see that same level of stratification for all those sites.
In July and August, you didn't see stratification?
Right, and each site was a little bit different too. Some sites performed a little, or have results a little bit differently than others. So I think there are six graphs on one page in the EBD, and you can kind of follow the progression by site as to how that stratification occurred.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions? Comments? Okay, well, thanks very much, everyone. Thank you, Andra.